For the
record, I'm pretty sure this is 4.
This is episode 4.
So okay, so I'm right.
Oh, you're 100% right.
How about?
I know, right? Yeah. So we're not going to keep that part in now. I came out of the gate swinging. Because you just dropped the S-bomb in the first minute and a half. So
you wanted more. You wanted more from me.
I did want some spice. I like it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Episode 3, Offensive Thoughts. You know, I know we were talking about this. This is Coach Gene Clemens. I am joined, as always, by Coach Whit LeJour. Whit, how are you doing?
I'm great. Can I stop you right there? I think we're on episode 4.
Are we on episode 4? Are you sure? Are you positive about
that? I think
I'd
like you to check. I'm not positive, but I think so.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. We're on episode 3.
Do your math. I believe you.
You believe me? Please.
Not
please
really.
Say you believe me.
Okay.
Please say you believe me, because it would be strange if you didn't. I'm actually looking at the, by the way, this is great podcast stuff, by the way. Don't think this is not going in. It's we're gonna chop this thing up a little bit. But there's an interesting bit on another podcast that I watch a lot, where every episode he asks what episode they're on.
Yeah.
And he always gets it wrong. He always gets it wrong. But for the record, I'm pretty sure this is 4. This is episode 4.
So, okay, so I'm right.
Oh, you're 100% right.
How about?
I know, right? Yeah. So we're not going to keep that part in now.
I came out of the gate swinging.
Because you just dropped the S-bomb in the first minute and a half. So
you wanted more. You wanted more from me.
I did want some spice. I like it. Anyway.
So I brought the glasses.
Oh, is that what it is? The glasses bring out the curse words in you?
Yeah.
I thought lack of defense brought out the curse words in you. That's where you tend to get a little bit more animated. I did notice that about you. Offensive ineptitude did not really get as irked. You didn't really get as irked about that. I felt like you always thought that the offense would come around at some point.
Is that? Yeah, I believe that, but I think that's accurate, and I think astute of you to pick up. But I also think most coaches have a side of the ball, whether it's football or basketball. Most have a side of the ball. Then I think you got to – I'm fighting off a cold, too, a pretty nasty one. And then you got to decide, where your emphasis with the players is going to be. So, you know, you can't be – I mean, you can try to do both, but, you know, you got to pick your – you got to have your – you know, I think they got to know what you're in for. So.
Gotcha. I've always considered myself to be a defensive coach, but quite honestly, well, when we're talking basketball, I'm definitely a defensive coach. When we're talking football, I'm a lot more of an offensive guy than defensive, which is really strange to be on both sides of it. But I think it really comes down to like what your feel is. I have a really good feel on a basketball court, and I think that feel tends to play itself out more on the offensive side of the ball than it does necessarily defensively. But feel is also as far as like football, yeah, I mean, I think both ways. It's weird. I don't know why, but I always tend to lean on defense when I play basketball.
Bottom line, I think you got to be better on both sides today more than ever before. I think the games are way more sophisticated than they were. I think I've had that debate before, but I think the games are played at a higher level. I think there's a lot of factors, particularly, you know, on video, online, accessibility to information. So the game's being played at a higher level on both sides of the ball. Europe has had an influence in basketball for sure. So
I don't particularly like the Europe influence as much.
I think it's a positive influence. So for all our European listeners out there, I'm a supporter.
Yeah, no, I mean, I like the I like the European game, but we don't play the European game. We just take the European
No.
influence, which is what I
No.
don't particularly like. Like if we adopted the full game, then I think we'd be, you know, cooking with some grease. But the fact that we're still trying to play this the way we play it, but we're allowing in all of these other nuances that don't, I don't think always mesh well together. I don't know. So
Well, I
you think,
disagree. And in fact, I think we, I completely disagree. And I think
okay.
we incorporate them because they produce results. And whether it's a guy like Pop, who's had a history of, European on his coach, Messina, the finest European coach maybe in history on the Spurs bench. They're just ideas that find their way into the game. We know the history of the Olympics. At one time, obviously, the U.S. could get away with college guys. Now that would be unthinkable. So anyway, all the influences, they don't have to be Europe. All the influences from all over the world help produce a better game, my humble opinion. So,
No, I'm not gonna argue with you on it.
yeah.
I think that you make great points. I just think that all
Thank
of
you.
the I think that all of the I think it can't be lost that a lot of what people are doing internationally came from watching us. So it's like
Well, that's true too.
they're doing what we do. They've just kind of done a little remixing to it, and then now we're pulling it back in to what
That's
we
fair.
do.
It's a global game.
I'm okay with that. I like anything that makes the game better. Speaking of making the
One
game
set of
better.
rules would help. One set of rules would help too. So down the line, FIBA rules will become universal.
Well, that was my point really about the European thing was really like adopting FIBA's rules as the rules for everything and then calling it a day. We talk about making the game better or worse, and we were rolling around this idea of the 3-point shot. You were saying that Bob Ryan's Boston Globe Bob Ryan is the 3-point shot is bad for basketball. And of course, you know, Bob Ryan is 157 years old, so I guess that would make sense. He probably remembers a time where there was no 3-point shot, and or when it wasn't nearly as prevalent as it is now. But what do you think? Like, do you think it's something where that you could say the 3-point shot is ruined or is bad for the game?
No, I mean, I don't. I know where he's coming from, and he's seen it before, and then the infant stages when, Bird and those guys were coming out when you had great shooters who only used it very selectively. And then, obviously, I think some of the gist of his argument would be just watching guys and gals at every age who have no business shooting it, just chucking it up. And, we've all seen games like that. So I'm not sure. Three-point shots not going anywhere. My opinion, 3-point shots here to stay. I think we are likely to see either the line move out, or and I may again, I'm sad to say we may see a 4-point line because the term is already in use. 4-point spacing, people will use it instead of saying NBA spacing. You'll hear 4-point spacing, and kids almost intuitively know that you just mean a few feet further back. So I think the 3-point line should move back at the higher levels of the game, just like it has been easing its way back. And I think it should be at a distance that only that basically that not all five players can willy-nilly throw it up. So that teams have to organize their offense in such a way, and defenses then have to guard in such a way that there's greater decision making. And I think right now, that's not the case. So, and that may not be the best for the game.
Yeah, I don't know. So do I think the 3-point line is bad for basketball? No. Would I love to see the game taught in a way that made the 3-point line not feel like the scapegoat for bad basketball? Yes. And I think that's what we've got right now is people are blaming the 3-point line for bad basketball. In reality, it's just bad basketball. Like coach better, teach better, develop better, show people. My model is Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant is not seeking out the three-point line. He's the best player in basketball. So if a guy like Kevin Durant can be the most lethal offensive weapon in the game of basketball, in my opinion, then without just 100% seeking out the three-point line, then why can't these other young men and women that are playing the game do the same? And that's where I think the Steph Curry effect comes in at. Now, follow me on this one. It's not that Steph Curry is bad for basketball or the same way that the three-point line is. It's that Steph Curry has made it seem as if he's just a regular you or me guy. And because he looks like a regular Joe, because he's not 6'11" like Kevin Durant, because he doesn't jump out the gym, because he's not blowing by people at breakneck speeds, people have somehow, and to a certain extent, because he's a light-skinned guy, people have like all of a sudden made this notion that he just, you know, pulled himself up by the bootstraps and worked really hard in the gym, and now he shoots. It's like, yeah, he did all that, but nobody ever talks about the way in which he was taught the game, how he never shot on a rim, that he could not shoot a perfectly formed jump shot until he was strong enough to do so. He was bred up to be the shooter that he was because the person who birthed him was probably one of the best shooters in the history of the game. And it's the part that we miss. But I think that's the part where Joe Schmo, you know, 7-8-year-old is rolling around throwing up threes, you know, by heaving them because he thinks that's right. And then his form's all broken up and now he's got to redevelop it and so on and so forth.
Right. Right. And then I think you're right. And then the other thing people miss on Steph Curry is how exceptionally well he moves without the ball in order to get those shots that he gets. So I think the argument for Ryan would be more that the stand around and chuck stuff with people that have no business more than watching a Curry who, again, could have played in any generation of the game. So
because he's special. But that's because he's special, you know. Like there are no more Curries out there rolling around just hanging out. Like did people think there are, but they're not.
Right. Well, you know, the Hawks have a guy that's, you know,
is different he Curry though?
Yeah, he's different. Curry? Than
that, but. See, and that's my point, right? Like Steph Curry. Everything about this dude is original, except the thing that he does better than almost probably anyone who's ever done it, people just think they can do. Like, it's like the fact, like, people know they can't be LeBron James. You know you can't be LeBron James. His measurables are something that's inhuman. His ability to jump, his ability to run, all that mixed with the basketball IQ, a lot of people realize they can't be LeBron James. But everybody looks at Steph Curry and thinks they could be Steph Curry. And you can't. Seth Curry can't be Steph Curry. And people keep wanting him to be. And it's like, man, how much would it suck to be Seth Curry having to go through life with people thinking you should be your brother because you have similar measurables and your father and mother are the same? Like it's not going to happen. I think that's something that really skews the game because we do get influenced by the people who do this game before we decide we're going to play. I'm sure you modeled your game after people that you saw. I modeled my game after people that I saw. I'm sure neither one of us came anywhere close to those people, but we still did it. It's interesting that way. I don't know.
Oh, move the line back. I do support that. Move the line back.
Absolutely. I think the line should be one that's daunting. Like when you look down at that line and you look at the rim, you should look at that and go, man, that's far. I think when I look at the three-point line.
No, no, exactly. I think more players should have to think twice, and then coaches should have to think about, you know, instead of being able to fall back on the analytics of the value of the three, more coaches ought to be faced with having to teach roles and the game and some of that stuff. So I think that could happen if you moved it back. But
absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I mean, the game, especially we're talking a lot of NBA right now, which is interesting. Well, maybe not NBA. We were just talking more about, you know, an NBA player. But speaking of NBA, it would be fair to say that you are a Celtics fan, correct?
Extremely fair. I mean, grew up one young age and, you know, pride myself on, you know, having watched a lot of the Bird era, which was some of the heyday stuff. And then obviously excited to watch the Garnett years. So, and now everything has happened since. So,
yeah. Yep. And I consider myself to be a Lakers fan. My earliest recollection of basketball is Magic. That's my guy. Everybody says, who's your number one? I say Magic. And people like over Jordan, like you like who you like, I like who I like. Magic is my guy. Also have an extreme amount of love for Larry Bird, just for the record. Really, really.
Magic was my brother's. Magic was my brother's guy too.
Yeah.
Same argument.
My brother and I have contended that Larry Bird might be one of the most underrated basketball players in the history of basketball.
That's not bad.
For as good as people will let you know he is, they don't even scratch the surface on some of the stuff the dude did that just went under the radar because, you know, all the other stuff looks so commonplace, I guess. But that's an argument. I mean, that's a discussion for another day. The discussion
And if Bird, again, really either one of them, but if Bird had been around in the heyday, the three-point shot, oh, my God.
Oh my gosh. Is there any doubt he would have averaged 40 points a game for sure?
I mean, if he wanted to, he would have, sure.
He averaged what, like mid 20s without even really being like I'm trying to score a guy.
Yeah, with good players around him. But anyway, that would build into our next conversation, I know.
It definitely does. Because we both love our teams and our teams don't seem to love the W's right now. What's wrong? What's wrong in the sense of a couple of years ago, it looked like the Celtics were on the cusp of another run. They had a bunch of young, talented guys that were starting to come into their own. A couple of years ago, the Lakers win it all in the bubble. Or a couple seasons ago, the Lakers win it all in the bubble. It looked like they had an opportunity to go on another run, and now we're here where neither team looks like they are in position to make a run at anything except for like a 7 seed. So what happened? What's going on?
Well, I think it's hard. There's a lot of arguments running around Boston. So, you know, one thing is it seems clear like Kyrie's been let off the hook at least a little bit by the people that were haters there that kind of blamed him, and obviously he didn't have a terrific time here and has yet to kind of be the guy in Brooklyn either. But that being said, you know, the duo of Tatum and Brown, which is where people look first, have underachieved up to this point and seems like the team has beaten its head against the wall. And Ainge is out of town, ready maybe to take another job. I mean, most people think that was not a resignation, if you will. They had to do something. I've said from the beginning, I will be very surprised if Brad Stevens is in the organization, you know, 12 months from now or longer. Because I think he's a coach, not a GM, but that's neither here nor there. And then now the fact that this thing looks like an even bigger rebuild than they ever imagined. So Danny Ainge's plan, I mean, the Celtic faithful have been waiting for some on years through the draft and, you know, our own version of Philly's process. And now to be stuck, you know, behind dysfunctional Philly, I mean, that's unbelievable. And so this year they're playing a little bit of defense and at times better basketball, but obviously the most recent road trip where they went 1-4 and finished by getting dismantled by the Suns minus Booker and Ayton, lead everyone into tonight in panic mode hosting the Bucks. You know, so every once in a while, obviously the Celtics, you know, I look, that's when they play well, when they, you know, they'll play well. They'll give you a nugget every once in a while and make things well. And then they'll just go back into their coma like playing style. So again, what's wrong? I think it's a lot. I think they're overrated players. I don't think it's a coach issue, obviously. I think it was a talent evaluation with draft picks that are getting little done on the floor as supporting players. And I think you need an alpha. So what I heard most recently that I liked a little bit was likening Tatum to the Pierce years and then getting Garnett, that Pierce is obviously a Hall of Famer, but wasn't a winner, right, until Garnett came to town, that Tatum may require the same sort of alpha. I buy into that. But I would buy into anything because it's just this movie's getting really old. So I'm not sure. And that's like, obviously, as a coach, sensitive to making too many assessments with a straight face when I haven't been to a single practice or, you know, really don't know a thing. Here's what I know. The NBA is hard. It's hard to win. It's hard to win in all these places. But the Celtics have had enough time with this core to know they're going nowhere. So there's going to be changes. And I think the question becomes, the question is, you know, who's out of town first? Smart, Tatum, or Brown?
Well, it's interesting because I feel like in Boston's case, Smart has a very Garnett-like attitude. You know, the way in which he seems like an alpha. Now, he's not Garnett, obviously, but he seems like an alpha. My biggest issue with the Celtics has always been I feel like they just have too many guys that do the exact same thing. And when you have so many of those guys, why did you never flip those guys for someone that did something different? And you know, it was like I feel like the flack that Kyrie received was, well, you know, Kyrie needs the ball in his hand too much, and it's like, yeah, but it's not a bad guy to have the ball in his hand. If you're going to have a guy with the ball in his hand, Kyrie's not a bad option. But he got so much flack for it, and the fact that they thought he was stunting the younger talents, you know, potential, when maybe the younger talents are who they are, you know, and that becomes an issue. I think with the Lakers, it's interesting because I think that the Lakers getting the championship in the bubble put some aroma on or put some band-aids on a situation that didn't really fit correctly for a longer period of time, and then they're old. So it's like, when you add in age and people who are kind of stuck in their ways because that's how they've always played and that's how they found their success, and then a coach who, for all intents and purposes, now has a championship, so you have to say he's a championship coach, but not necessarily someone that many people believed was really the driving force behind the positive that was going on the team, because you heard all of these things about Jason Kidd and how Jason Kidd was kind of like pulling some strings back there, and you know, and so it's now you just have a team that looks like it's two different teams trying to coexist at one. There's a team where LeBron is LeBron and he does what he does, and then there's a team with, you know, Russell Westbrook and what he does, and they kind of do the same thing, but you know, one is just I don't even know how to explain it, but it feels like what they need to do would take somebody being more humble than they're willing to be. And that's the problem with the Lakers. Like, they have a situation where they have two guys who clearly do the same thing. One yep. happens to be LeBron. One happens to be Russell Westbrook, who I love, by the way, for as much flack as he gets. I still love, like, Russell Westbrook. I loved him before he was a Laker. I love that he's on the Lakers and he's done it his way. And but they do the same thing. And so to me, it seems like an easy fix. One guy's got to go to the bench, and then you've got to just have one of those guys on the court at all times and let them do their thing. But I don't know if people are willing to really go there with Russell Westbrook, because you can't ask LeBron to come off the bench. He's LeBron, you know?
Right. Well, so, here's what I got. The Lakers are in a much better situation than the Celtics. So let's establish that right away. They've got LeBron, so their problems are fixable. Yeah, they've got AD, who's maybe the key to the whole deal. Mm-hmm. You know, Frank Vogel, hey, that's, people are always going to take shots at coaches they don't perceive as you know, having something. Casey Jones won a championship in Boston, and people thought that, you know, he wasn't necessarily the best coach, but he was the right coach for them. So, you know, I think it's the NBA, as you know, is a players' league, and then you probably need the staff, the coaching staff that can fit whatever that personality or makeup of that group. Tyronn Lue, right, with the Cavs, whatever, you know, whoever you think is the right fit. But it doesn't have to be, obviously, what people might perceive to be like a coach's coach or something. So if you got LeBron, you got a chance. That's my perspective with the Lakers still. They can be the 7-5 Bucks last year, Tampa Bay, and, you know, kind of play for a playoff berth and then pull it together. They have what it takes to kind of do that. In the NBA, you can do that a little bit. The Celtics have proven nothing, but they play like they've proven something. And that's the fundamental problem with Boston. They act like they're good and they're terrible. And most honest people, that's what they think. They're terrible. They're not only are they not fun to watch, they're bad.
What do you think about the Celtics' new coach? Like, what do you think of him as a coach so far and what he's doing?
Well, I mean, I think he's fine. I think it was a new voice. That was right. He was preaching toughness early on. They're going to be, you know, hard coaching. That's what the group needed. I mean, that was all the, you know, public comments. And, you know, he was a pop guy, so I've got to imagine that was some of that was real. But, you know, at that level, and people can play 50%, but collect 100% of their paycheck. So, you know, good luck to any coach if you happen to be coaching guys that don't want to bring it. Like, you're just, it doesn't matter. You could have John Wooden on that bench. You could have Red Auerbach on that bench, and you've got a problem. So that's my take, that this goes clearly way beyond coaching. I think it does go to commonalities, similarities in the game. I've said that a long time ago. I wasn't sure if Brown and Tatum could coexist. I heard today they're passing numbers. The number of assists they have to one another is like extraordinary low. Like, Brown has 3 assists for baskets to Tatum. And Tatum has like 8 to Brown. And I mean, if you do the math on some of the other, it's kind of like, wow, I don't know. It's depressing, to be honest with you. It's depressing. I think Ainge, I think he got too much of a free pass. I mean, God bless him. And, you know, but I think he got a free pass, and now it's, unfortunately, other people's mess, including Udoka and now Brad Stevens. I think they're the folks that are cleaning up Danny Ainge's mess, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I Did Ainge really get a pass? I know that people kept going the whole doing the whole well, Danny Ainge fleeced people out of deals, but really all he did was lowball people for pieces that didn't really end up being what brought the Celtics over the hump. And I think people pointed that out, like, hey, what have you been hoarding all of these draft picks for? You haven't been able to flip them into the guy.
Yeah, so, I think he could have got I think they could have been harder on him. That's all I'm saying. I think people were really, really, really patient until it could be patient no more. And then this year was all about hope. Like, okay, it's going to be better. Like, how would it not be? And then all of a sudden it's not. So it's, hey, look, this is sport and there's some talent there. And tonight they could win. And, you know, I hope not. I mean, that's sad. I hope not. Just because,
you're hoping
like,
for the loss because you want everything to just get blown up.
Yeah. I mean, there are people calling for him to tank it, you know, the year and get a top 10 pick. And I think that's getting, you know, crazy, but I think they gotta, you know, they're gonna be changes, but I don't know. The NBA, you get, you know, the salaries are such that it's hard to make, you know, changes. Like I would do a Brown for Simmons. I would do anything. I'd make a desperate trade because
I just don't understand what tanking does. I don't understand the tanking unless the person that you're tanking for is LeBron James or Kevin Durant. Like, anybody else that you're tanking for is a guy you can find in the league. Like, these guys that are coming out right now, these guys are just replications of the overpaid, we call him a star, but he's really not a star player. I don't see any, there are no Shaqs. There are, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's no guy where I go, I really need to tank for this guy. You know what? Joel Embiid was a guy that was somebody that you should have tanked for. After you tank for Embiid, there's no reason to keep tanking. Once you have Embiid, just fill your team with guys that go well with him and call it a day. Because who are you going to get in the draft that's better than Tatum? Like that becomes the issue with tanking. And I love what Masai Ujiri did. He said, you know what? I know this guy's probably not going to stay in Toronto, but I'm getting him anyway because that's going to help our team win a championship and we'll figure it out from there. And they went from being a competitive team to a championship team. Some chips had to fall right, but there's can't take the chip away. And now they're back to still being a competitive team. No harm, no foul, but you got a chip out of it. And I think that if Danny Ainge had flipped those picks and a player into the brow when they said, well, he'll never stay in Boston, and he got gun-shy and tried to lowball and all that other stuff, he should have gotten Anthony Davis and took the run with Anthony Davis and see if they could have made it happen. At least – you'd be sitting here right now going, well, they tried, you know, they put all the chips into the center. And I think a lot of times these GMs keep trying to play for futures that they're never going to see. You see it happen in football all the time. Hey, we want to try to find a quarterback that's going to be here for the next 10, 12 years. Well, when does that happen? Like the only 10, 12 year quarterbacks that you see are Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, you know, like those are the guys who Aaron Rodgers, like those are the guys who end up being your 10, 12 year quarterbacks that actually get it done. The rest of them are Matt Ryans. And it's like, yeah, cool. You have a Matt Ryan. He's good. You're going to win some games. You're going to be serviceable. You're going to be good sometimes, but you're not winning chips. You're not winning chips. So I'd rather take the shot on the guy that could get it done right now or has an opportunity to get me closer to getting it done right now than to try to play a long game that I'm not guaranteed. I mean, coaches are getting fired left and right. It doesn't matter what level you're at. You know, the days of job security for a coach in almost any sport has gone the way of the dinosaur, unless you've been grandfathered into that security. And even then, if you put a few stinkers up on the board, they're looking at, hey, maybe it's time. You know, and so with that, you don't have time to wait for the future. You don't have time to try to see a 5, 6, 7, 8, 10-year plan out. You need to be thinking short term. Get it done now, maybe next year, possibly the year after. Because after that, you're gone. And until these front office guys and these coaches start realizing that, and they start being more demonstrative on what they need to get it done right now, or doing what they need to do to get it done right now, you're just going to continue to see all this turnover in coaches at all these places with talent, or at least with some talent. Because talent will get you wins, but talent will also get you fired. And that's what's happening in Boston right now.
I couldn't agree more.
So that leaves us back to college. We haven't talked any college. By the way, we came over here and we talked about how good Iowa was, and then Iowa went out and got beat.
Sorry about that.
Not Iowa. Sorry, Purdue. Purdue got beat.
Well, they both. I think might have mentioned beat. Iowa too.
Iowa got beat twice. Purdue got beat once. And didn't look very impressive while getting beat. By the way, they looked really bad.
We may be a little bit like the Sports Illustrated Jinx, the cover.
Yeah, we may have given them the kiss of death. I think they'll be okay, but who knows? I mean, I came over here talking about how good Gonzaga was, and then Gonzaga got rolled.
If we talk about you, you're in trouble.
We're talking. If we talk about you in a good light, you're definitely in trouble.
Yeah, you're definitely in trouble.
So speaking of that, let's talk about some college basketball teams. Memphis. It's an interesting thing happening in Memphis right now. The, you know, Penny Hardaway led team brought a lot of excitement, brought a lot of juice in when he came in. Hasn't been a lot of wins that have come along with Penny Hardaway since he's been there. What do you make of the situation down in Memphis?
Well, I know they I don't know if they won the NIT last year or what they were, but there were really strong expectations for this year. And then obviously they had top freshmen come in to a kind of a senior laden team. So expectations were very high. I know that. And so far the results have been way less than everyone anticipated. So I've read up on them. I haven't seen them play a ton, but you know, I just liken it to our past discussion, where talent is one thing, but culture and chemistry are another. And it would seem to me that at the very least, the chemistry's off with this Memphis team, meaning some guys that were practicing all summer together, but then were thrust onto the court with a couple of new faces, freshmen, haven't gelled the way that everyone thought they would. And so, you know, that could be as simple as chemistry and therefore time, or it could be something like culture. And when you think culture, just to go back to the NBA again real quick for a second, I just think of Pat Riley. Like, now what would Pat Riley do if he was in charge of the Celtics? That's what I want to know. That would, right? And I know he's a Celtics hater for life, so arch nemesis, but that's what I'd love to see, what a guy like Riley, because he's done that with the Heat, regardless of, you know, they've got a competitive product, and he's going to make sure, right? And Jimmy Butler stands for what that culture is all about. So my point is, at the college level, where many of these guys, the highest level, are going to seek pro careers, you've got the same chemistry and ultimately culture issue. So that's what I think it boils down to when someone underachieves. Either there's a chemistry issue for whatever reason, could be injuries, could be young, could be, you know, whatever it is, could be coaching, or there's a culture issue, you know, which again involves both coaches and players. So to me, there is obviously something to do with one of those in Memphis. But, you know, there's only one good thing that happens when you underachieve, right? No, pretty soon no one expects anything from you. And then the next thing you know, you're a sleeping giant. So put Memphis into the sleeping giant category, because sooner or later, as long as they can win enough to make the tournament, they'll be a tough out.
I think this, I'm going to file this one under beware what you wish for. Beware what you wish for, because they had Tubby Smith, and for whatever anyone wants to say about Tubby Smith, he's a good coach. He's a good coach, cares about these young men. He's here to be a coach and an educator. He's dedicated his life to it. It's never really been a whole big about Tubby kind of thing. At least that's been my read. I've met him once or twice, had a good little like 30-second conversation with him. That's as much as I know about him personally. When you say, "Hey, Tubby, you're putting a good product on the court, but you know, we lost a couple guys who didn't really want to buy into your discipline structure and what you wanted out of them, and we lost them to other teams. So we're going to get you out of here. We're going to bring in a coach who is coming straight from, let's take the name out of it. We're going to bring in a coach who's coming straight from essentially the high school ranks or the ranks of travel ball, the high school travel ball ranks. And we all understand that those guys tend to be really good at getting talent. But when they come up against guys when they come up against foes who are really disciplined, really understand the game, who play it the quote unquote right way, they tend to fall short. And
but
so
that's a little outrageous on your part, because what you've just done is you've compared Penny Hardaway to your run-of-the-mill travel ball guy. And Penny Hardaway, you know, is basketball royalty, essentially, who simply was coaching at a lower level. So I think you got to be careful with that analogy. The same way, you know, unless you want to go the route that
he wasn't a coach.
People would say the same thing about Steve Nash.
I mean, I said the same thing about Steve Nash. What do you mean? Okay. But at least Steve Nash went into an organization at the NBA level and was around that organization kind of learning some things about it. Penny Hardaway was barely even a high school coach before he took over. Like this was a meteoric rise for what we have known as the established way that you normally get to a head coaching position. And I'm not mad at it, because I've seen coaches who don't look like Penny Hardaway get that meteoric rise as well. So I'm cool with Penny Hardaway getting it, but I can't be a hypocrite.
I think it's closer to our past discussion about Al Skinner in Boston College, because the bottom line, Memphis had a proven coach and a proven person and a proven, you know, something that you would a lot of people would value highly, right? Something stable and
absolutely
all that's good. And so they got greedy, in my language, right? They did what BC did. Well, we can get something that's going to take us to some new height, and I think that's the problem sometimes with folks in the highest levels of decision making. Like, it's a gamble. So if you're right to do it, and then you know when it doesn't work out, you know you're going to have to answer, not to you and me, but you're just going to have to answer to the fact that you let someone go or you let something go that was good, and the rebuild, the reconstruction of that is often a lot tougher than if you had just stuck with something more proven. So, we're still, this is still early on. So,
well, but that's the thing, right? I was just saying, you don't have a long time now. So so my problem is, be careful what you wish for, Memphis, but now you got to be patient. This man is learning on the job. And if you're learning on the job, then the person that hires you, knowing that you don't have said requisite, you know, experience, they have to be willing to go through these times where, hey, you know, it's penny. These wins aren't really, you know, what it is. Like NIT win normally flips into a really good program the next year. That's kind of been how it works. You win the NIT the next year, you tend to make that next step to the tournament and maybe even make some noise in the tournament. So when and if that does not happen, will there start to be rumblings that we don't know if Penny Hardaway is the guy? And my answer to that is you got to be patient. You have to be patient because you've got to allow him the opportunity to grow into the position that he probably wasn't ready to have when you gave him the position.
And the only thing I disagree with there, I don't think you have to. I mean, if you make the decision, these guys at this level of college athletics are getting paid enough that, you know, you pay them, and then when time comes that you no longer think they're the guy, you let them go. The guys I feel sorry for are the assistant coaches that are not making the same kind of money, and even the assistant coaches down the ladder, you know, where your next job isn't guaranteed and things like that. That's who really pays the piper on stuff like this.
Absolutely. But like, what do you then gain? Because if you're just bringing in new guy after new guy after new guy, then what do you know what? If South Carolina,
it's a PR gain. That's what it is. It's a PR gain to let your people know, the boosters know, you know, your fandom know we're doing something. We're on the case. So it's a little bit like the pro, right? It's likened to the pro stuff that, you know, it's a lot easier to fire the baseball manager than 25 guys in uniform.
Facts.
So you do it. Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I just don't like it because I feel like Penny Hardaway can be a really quality quality basketball coach. I just don't know if he's there yet. You know what I'm saying? Like
There's a lot to be said. You're right, growing on the job. Josh Pastner, young coach. You know, there's a lot of guys that are that you know, growing the job. So you give them time, and that's, you know, that's definitely.
Some people don't get the second swing. That's the part. Like, there's no guarantee that if Penny Hardaway, if it doesn't work out for him at Memphis, that he gets the second swing at a program that's going to allow him to prove that he's learned on the job. So I don't know. And I'm with you. I always feel bad for the assistant coaches because, you know, they're the ones that have to figure it out on the fly. And most times, you know, their buyouts don't look anywhere near like the head coach's buyout. So that's always problematic. I got a question for you. When do you personally, when do you ignore what your body is telling you?
Well, when do I ignore it?
When do you ignore it?
I'd love to say, you know, I'd love to say never. But occasionally, I might, if I've had one too many drinks and my body's telling me I've had one too many, I might ignore it then. I can have that one more or something. So that might be a case of ignoring what my... I don't know if that would be what my body's telling me as much as that my mind is telling me. When do I ignore what my body's telling me? I'm a little messed up right now. Again, I started this thing. I'm really not feeling great. So it's like I'm trying to ignore every signal that my body's giving me. I'm literally, like, all I want to do is sit down, lie down. You know, that's what I've been doing for part of the day. So when do I ignore? I ignore it in competition. That's another time I ignore what my body, right? If I'm aching, sore, injured, something like that, but I'm out competing these days, maybe on the golf course, but could be something else, right? Then that's enough to, again, I don't know if that's my mind or my body, but I'm going to ignore the signals that my body's sending me.
And I think that's where I'm getting at, because we hear so many times people say, listen to your body. Listen to your body. Like, if your body tells you this, then believe it. But listening to your body, the older you get, means you kind of can't do a whole lot of things. And that's where I'm at. And I'm obviously not to your level yet. I pray to one day be there. But as a 41-year-old man, there are things that my body says that if I listen to it, I feel like I would never do anything. Like, my body right now is telling me, your knee hurts. Go sit down, put it up. But it tells me that every day. So if my body's telling me, hey, these knees aren't the greatest, you know, you need to rest them. Does that mean I don't work out? Does that mean I don't like go and dance? Does that mean there are a lot of things that I do where I hear you, body. I hear what you're saying, and I would love to listen to you, except life is going on out here, and I want to continue to live it.
It's great timing, your question. One of the books I told you I was sitting around today reading is this Rise of Superman, and I recommend it. It's all about ultimate performance, decoding the science of ultimate performance. Stephen Kotler, one of my players in sports psychology class, gave it to me here before the break. I'd asked him and said he recommended it. I had not read it yet. But anyway, the book is about flow, right? We all know flow, the zone, and is using extreme athletes as the supermen or the teachers of flow. And the basic premise seems to be, I'm barely a third into the book, these guys that are risking life and limb, doing things in the last 20 years that were virtually impossible to think of, right? Have the greatest to teach us about getting there. And to your point, the number one thing seems to be, like, these are people that are defying their body. I mean, they're doing things with, you know, because they're hurt all the time. These skateboarders going off, jumping the Great Wall of China, and surfers going on, you know, waves 60 feet higher than what they once did, right? They're doing it, and they're doing it hurt. And so if they were listening to their body at all, they wouldn't be accomplishing any of this stuff, and the end game is entering the zone. So I'm going to say, because I haven't read the end of the book yet, you know, if you at 42 and me at 62 want to achieve the zone as we continue to age, then one of the lessons might be ignore your body. You have to continue to, and I've done that some too, right? That's a physical training. Train the thing that hurts you. I use that within reason. Like, if I, that's what you got to, sometimes you see a doctor, but other times when something is aching, lower back or your leg, this or that, that's the exact body part you have to work. So don't fear the ache, you know, work it. Go after that thing. Ignore your body. So that's my, I think you're onto something. I know you are, and I'm giving you scientific evidence in the name of a book.
I appreciate it, and I have now downloaded that book already, and I will be starting that this evening. I bring it up because I am going for my 100th ride at Cycle Bar this evening. It's going to be 100 rides, and I am infinitely better at spinning than I was the first time I did a spin class, where I felt like a bumbling idiot and I walked out with my head spinning because I was so like exhausted. And now I'm pretty badass, you know, on the spin cycle. So going for my 100th class, and the thing that—
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The thing that I notice, something that can help you ignore your body, is when there are beautiful women everywhere.
And why did I know you were going there?
Listen, I don't know if people understand. I don't know if guys understand it, because working out has become this big machismo thing for guys. And it's like, oh, I'm going to work out. I'm not going to do that. That seems girly. That's what I heard. Oh, well, spin class. That seems girly. Well, yeah, if you make it girly, but while you're doing the spin class, that seems girly, that you don't actually have to make girly. You can make it grueling. You can make it taxing. You get to be surrounded by a bunch of like motivation everywhere you look. I could solve obesity very easy just by putting visual motivation in front of people. Because I tell you, there is nothing that makes me work harder. There's nothing that makes me work harder than knowing that I am in the company of all of these badass, like, you know, super chicks who all are just killing it, and they look great, and they appreciate that you're killing it. I think that's a great thing. I think we need to do more of getting our men to go to classes that they think might be girly. Yoga classes, spin classes, Orange Theory, Pure Bar, all of those classes that we have been kind of ingrained to believe that they are feminine and they're not for us. We're about the weightlifting and the running. And quite honestly, I can't run anymore. Like, my knees hurt way too long after running than they do. I can spin almost every day. In fact, I have been to a spin class for 8 straight days. If I tried to actually go out and run 3 days in a row, I would have to take 4 days off because my knees would be swollen, my joints would be hurting. Like, that's a thing. And so, like, not only can we listen to our body by not doing the things that are going to destroy it more, but we could also like have a little bit of fun and enjoy the visuals that come along with those things as well.
Well, leave it to you. I could not dispute anything that I've heard.
MB, I love you, MB.
Yeah, wow. Okay, I mean, we all knew that women were smarter. Now you've put out there that they're tougher, but we knew that too.
We knew that too. Anyways. Yeah.
You know,
someone should try to figure out how to bottle the toughness of a woman, because it really is remarkable if you think about it. And I know we're going to wrap it up here, but if you were able to kind of just bottle up the toughness of someone that can have another human come out of their body, I think that would sell really, really well on the market.
I would tell you this. I mean, we probably could. I know what my wife would say. If you just listen to us more, you'd probably be okay. Like, you know, all you got to do, guys. Right. All you got to do is listen.
By the way, have you heard of the Air app?
No.
You have not heard of the Air app. Well, when you get a spare moment, I want you to actually go and like look up like what the Air app is, because it is my idea that I had almost 10 years ago now.
Wow.
That has come to fruition.
I hate when that happens.
It has finally come to fruition, and I just wish that I would have, you know, really been more demonstrative on it. We'll talk about that another time. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been episode number 4, by the way. Episode 4. Of offensive thoughts. That is Coach Witt. I am Coach Gene Clemens. Thank you for joining us. Make sure that you like and subscribe to the podcast. Make sure you like the episode. Make sure you leave some comments. You know, we'd love to hear from you. Leave some comments. You can catch us on Spotify and any of those other places that you find on podcasts. That we'd love to hear from you. And until next time, y'all take it easy.
Go Bucks.